Well, good morning. It is Thursday, and welcome to Perspectives on WFSU-FM. I'm Tom Flanagan. Thank you so much for tuning in and for being part of the conversation at 414-1234. If you'd like to hop in at any time during the proceedings, long distance is 800-926-8809, and perspectives at WFSU.org is the email address. Well, we've heard that song and that saying so doggone many times. It's the most wonderful time of the year. It's inescapable. It seems as though every commercial radio station or Sirius XM channel you dial up has that playing by one of any number of hundreds of people. But that may not hold true for everyone, because you've got all the images of love and joy that are floating about, and TV screens and magazine pages are showing the wonders of this time of year. But for a lot of people, it's just a very stressful time at this end of year point. And you've got things like family dysfunction and loss and so much other things combined with occasional overindulgence when it comes to those things that change our mood. And even the weather sometimes conspires to put a more depressive look on the end of year. Well, we're going to talk a little bit about holiday depression here, particularly as it relates to suicide here on Perspectives, but what we want to do is to have a more positive forward look as well, because coming up next month is going to be a major conference, which is hosted by NAMI Tallahassee, NAMI, standing for National Alliance on Mental Illness, on January 27th and 28th, a suicide prevention conference at Tallahassee Community College. And we will have lots more of that to talk about in the course of the next 53 minutes or so. But first, let's go around and meet our panel here. Joining us first, Mary Bowers, parent of Brooke Bowers, who struggled with mental health issues for many years before committing suicide herself at her Tallahassee home in January 2011 at the age of 31. But Mary, you're a former NAMI president as well, correct?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Thank you again for coming to grace our microphones. We appreciate that. Right next door, from the Appalachian Center, the head guy over there, Jay Reeve. And Jay, it is wonderful to see you, sir.
Well, it's a pleasure to be back, and I'm excited about being able to talk about this topic, because NAMI Tallahassee is doing some amazing stuff with the Lost Team right now.
And we will find out exactly what that Lost Team concept is from the progenitor of it momentarily. But we have one other guy here with us in studio to talk about, and from the Tallahassee Community College Police Force, Chris Summers. And Chris, how you doing, sir?
Hey, good morning, Tom.
It is great. Let's move on to the telephone, where we are joined by a fellow by the name of Dr. Frank Campbell, sir, currently serving as senior consultant for Campbell and Associates Consulting. He's past executive director of the Baton Rouge Crisis Intervention Center, the Office of Clinical Research and Consultation, and the Crisis Center Foundation. Frank, living out in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and is a licensed clinical social worker certified in thanatology, and his work includes providing consultation in forensic suicidology. And Dr. Frank, welcome, but I didn't even know those things exist. Talk about those two areas, would you please?
Well, thank you, Tom. I'm glad to add to your vocabulary this morning. I tell you, the short course is anything that ends in ology just means study of. And so we know that psychology is the study of the mind. Thanatology, named after the Greek god of death, Thanatos, is the study of death and dying. So all manner of death would fall into that area. And I guess I could say in graduate school it was a shorter line to stand in. So I was attracted to that short line.
Well,
suicidology is the study of suicide as a or one cause of death. So it's a field of practice that focuses on just that cause of death. Does that help?
Yeah, that does, but it leads us to another question, because Jay brought this up here just during the introductory part of the show, talking about loss teams, and I think that is your concept. What is a loss team?
Well, because I was doing a weekly bereavement group for families and friends and individuals who had experienced the death by suicide, much like Mary in your opening comments, I began to notice there was a long length of time between a death and they find help. And so we kind of described it as they stumbled onto help. And when I did the research and looked into it for our own community, we found the average elapsed time was over 4 years between the death and kind of stumbling in our door for services, even though we had been in operation for decades. So what I wanted to do and work with the coroner's office is find a way to get to the scene. We had attempted to reach out to first responders, and I'm sure that Chris, police chief, can identify a scene as a very chaotic environment. And so even though we worked really hard with law enforcement and the coroner's office and other first responders, they have a job to do there that's important and vital, and we have to have them do their job. To add another task, like helping the family know where to go when they're ready, wasn't effective at that time. What we hoped to do was to provide people at the scene who had been through a loss, had gotten help, were at a place now they could kind of do unto others as perhaps they wish could have been done for them, and just be at that scene as an installation of hope. Hope that, first of all, they're not alone. Secondly, they can get help and function again, because they don't believe that's possible at that moment. And when ready, lead them with the information about how to get more help and remain as a resource through the center to that family and friends as more come in for funerals and come and go in the community. So what we learned is, and our international average tends to continue this now after 20 years, is that people come in less than 60 days if they get a lost team visit at the home. And I think we all agree sooner is better than later.
Well, that is a concept, since your name was kind of taken in vain here, Chris Summers. Let's talk about the law enforcement aspect of that. Sure. You have a death investigation. You don't know if it is a suicide, if it is a homicide, if it is natural causes, whatever. Law enforcement responds. You guys have to be very analytical and somewhat emotionally distanced from this whole thing. Is that what Dr. Frank's talking about here?
Yeah, there's, our main mission and goal is a manner and a cause of a death. And then we work in conjunction with a medical examiner. So what the law enforcement responds and inherits at a scene becomes vitally important working towards that that conclusion of what we hope is the manner and the cause of death. In particular with suicides, it's an exclusionary investigation in that sometimes you may not be able to answer every single question about the why, but you begin from almost an opposite way of answering, well, what did not happen? So both physical evidence becomes very important. At the same time, interviews, witness information, what was happening in that person's life right at or leading up to that death. It all becomes very important, and hopefully answering the question and working with our medical experts in trying to really at the end of the day fill in and maybe answer some of the questions that families and loved ones have. That's probably the most difficult aspect, because the one who can really tell us the most is usually the one that's not available to talk to.
Exactly. And Jay Reeves, what does that mean as far as the survivors here in this situation? What this is sort of a cold response to something that is profoundly devastating to these people.
Well, I think you're right on point. Any kind of loss has a traumatic quality to it, but the death and the sort of self-willed death of someone who's a family member or someone who's close to you is one of the most profoundly traumatic experiences that anyone can go through. One of the things we know psychologically about trauma is that it has negative long-term impacts on both physical health and mental health, and that those negative long-term impacts can be reduced and sometimes completely alleviated if intervention is provided soon enough. So anything that allows, and it's not practical, and it's not really fair to load that onto law enforcement along with all the other things that law enforcement has to do. I think what you can ask of law enforcement in any situation, any kind of traumatic situation, is to interact with folks in a calm and empathic manner. And what I've seen from our local law enforcement is they do a great job of that. But there's another step, and that has to do with making sure that survivors feel heard that the anxiety and the trauma that is attendant upon suicide is something that they can talk about and not feel like they're sort of taking the spotlight away from the event and getting connected with help. So all those things are crucial to sort of reducing the long-term impact of the trauma.
And Mary Bowers, when you and Bill went through this with Brooke back in 2011, this was not available to you guys, right?
No, there are victim advocates who do partner. You know, they go out to the scene too. But I think what's important to know is I think I would have been a little bit more receptive, I think, or would have felt a little better if we would have had someone to say, hey, you're going to make it through. If I would have had another survivor there who could say, look at me, I'm, you know, dressed like you did. I can talk to you when you're ready about how I made it through this. And just to let you know, I'm here for you. You can call me anytime. The victim advocates do that as well. But we would be members of the community who are available long term. And we can, you know, go out and visit them one-on-one if we need to, you know, that type of thing. Because it took me quite some time before I was able to find any help. Went back to work. No one knew what to say to me. So even if we could start working with supervisors, you know, let them know what might be something that they could do if one of their employees or family members have a suicide in their family, what they could do to help that survivor when they go back. So there's lots of things that can be done.
And Chris, want to get to you here in just a second. I know we're bearing down on a break really rapidly, so I want to give you full opportunity to get your input here on this question, too, along with you, also Dr. Frank, as we talk to an upcoming program that will be happening at Tallahassee Community College, hosted by NAMI Tallahassee on January 27th and 28th, a suicide prevention conference that also is going to focus on the needs of the survivors of that situation. 414-1234. Give us a call. Back on Perspectives on WFSU-FM, swinging into the holidays here, talking with representatives of NAMI Tallahassee and Appalachian Mental Health, the TCC Police Department, and also one of the preeminent experts when it comes to suicidology and thanatology, which I am so happy I learned those new words here this morning, Dr. Frank. Get to you in a second, but Chris Summers, go ahead. Continue your thought, if you would.
Yeah, I think an important aspect of this and something that, you know, what Mary mentioned, it's an important aspect. It can be something that really can assist, particularly in the immediate aftermath, but it's often sometimes a pitfall or a stumbling block for those of us in that first response mode. And it comes down to the ability for that person to understand what that family, what that loved one is going through, and really not address the right way. If you say you understand, but you haven't walked in their shoes, it can be very devastating and traumatic, or at least a setback. When you've been through what that person has been through, that adds a tremendous and powerful component to really where they begin to rebuild their lives. And that's, I think, one of the key things within Law's team is that there are people that have the ability to say they understand, but actually do understand because they have been through very similar situations. And I just thought it was a very, you know, important thing to kind of hit right there early in the conversation, that the goal is to build that group, that team of folks that can come in and meet with a family or a loved one who sadly has been through what they've been through, and because of that has the ability to now kind of pay it forward and reduce, hopefully, some of the trauma.
That's a terrific point. And Dr. Frank Campbell, that I think is the one thing that we who have not perhaps experienced this firsthand in our own situation have wrestle with all the time. You want to say, yes, I understand, I empathize, I'm here for you and all that, but we cannot totally connect because we haven't been through that, and it sounds so empty.
Well, that's right, Tom. This is a cause of death, as the Chief and Jay and Mary pointed out. It brings trauma with it. You have sensory exposure, you have an emotional connection. In some cases, they may have discovered or found the body. So there is a plethora of resources that are available in the community that at that moment are completely off the front windshield. No one's thinking about that. They're just trying to cope minute to minute while a death scene investigation is going on, which needs to progress. It needs to be properly conducted because you want to rule out foul play. But during that time, that individual is sinking further and further into a dissociative kind of environment to cope. And you have someone who's been through a traumatic loss, and suicide is the most consistent traumatic death every community experiences, and all of Florida, because the national average, you're so much higher in the U.S. in suicide, you're going to have folks that have been through this traumatic loss and have no one, actually, that they can relate to. Even though suicide is number 10 cause of death compared to homicide at 17, and you'll have almost 3.5 times as many more people die by suicide than homicide, very few people have ever been at a scene where there's a homicide. So it's easy within 100,000 people to not be that 12 people that experience suicide every year. Having someone at the scene who's been through another traumatic death allows that family member to connect, because this loss team is local outreach. Because it's important that it be local people who have benefited from the services. But importantly also is that we're not there to say this is a suicide. We're there just to say you've had a traumatic death. And if they say, well, did you go through this? So they can say, well, yes, I did. In my case, it was suicide. Many times the family and law enforcement have already reached a temporary conclusion around suicide, but the teams are not there to make that call as the chief so clearly points out. That's a decision to be made down the road once all the evidence has been sorted.
Okay, Mary Bowers, talk about how do you form a loss team? What, besides someone who has been through a suicide situation personally, who else are you looking for to be part of that, and how big a team is practical if you're going to triage these kinds of things?
Well, we don't have a team yet. That's going to be hopefully one of the outcomes of the second day of this conference. So I know a number of people who are survivors of suicide loss. So many of them, I'm hoping, will come to the conference. They have told me that they will. And loss survivors can come at no cost because we do want them there. They're critical. Their attendance is critical so they can get trained and listen to Frank and understand it a little bit and get support from other survivors. But also we're going to need like mental health professionals too. These are all volunteers. So be aware of that. It's not – no one will be providing counseling. But we will – we would like to have mental health providers, clergy, retired police officers – Anyone who has a history of working with suicide prevention. Social workers, even policymakers, you know, having Jay here to say that this is such a great idea for the community means a lot to us to have that support from the different hospitals in town.
Yeah, I'm even thinking some, you say policymakers, I'm thinking city, county commissioners, you know, people of that ilk, leadership roles in local or state government here. This could be a big part of this as well.
It could indeed. You know, one of the interesting things that's been happening in this community lately course of the past year or two has been a real emerging focus on mental health and behavioral health issues, and a lot of leadership has been shown, especially by our county commission in that, which is great to have been part of. And Appalachia Center and Tallahassee Memorial Behavioral Health Center are thrilled to see grassroots efforts like this emerging. We want to be able to support anything we can in terms of getting the community more engaged in the dialogue, the conversation, and reaching out to help people who've been through trauma.
Yeah, and Chief Summers, and not just situations regarding suicide, but in so many law enforcement situations, any emphasis on mental health component rather than the criminal element seems to be also a developing trend in law enforcement right now.
Right. As we speak, actually, there is a crisis intervention team, CIT, school going on right now, and it's delivered 2 to 3 times a year within the capital city area, as well as a statewide initiative undertaken by the Florida Sheriff's Association. And it's to add that advanced training, advanced knowledge on de-escalation, recognition of signs and symptoms of mental illness. And we're getting better each year. You have about 500-plus local law enforcement officers, deputy sheriffs, state officers that have been trained in first response to crisis incidents, and not just the training aspect, but also there is a segment of local resources. And many times that's as big a plus for the officers and the deputies and the folks out in the street to know what resources are available that somebody could reach out to maybe within the next 15, 20 minutes, maybe the very next morning. And that information is very powerful. And there's been that CIT itself is in probably, I think, the 12th year. Mm-hmm. But it's a concerted effort from our local partners, as Jay speaks about, my peer law enforcement executives in town who fully support it, and that the instructors donate their time. So really the investment is minimal, but the return is immeasurable. So it's really awesome.
Dr. Frank Campbell, Chief Summers just brought up a really wonderful point on the fact that not only are we talking about resources available for survivors of suicide, but since suicide prevention is a major component of what this conference later in January is going to be about, a lot of people want to know, what can I do if I suspect that there is someone in my family or in my circle of friends who has danger, warning signs? Can I intervene? Should I intervene? What should I do? Because no one wants to feel, if only I did this or had done that, this would not have happened.
Well, absolutely, Tom. I'm afraid that over the years, the stigma and shame around suicide, thousands of years of this now, built up to the point where people actually approach someone saying, or giving an indicator that they might be having thoughts of suicide, they approach it as if they would set that person off, as though they're a bomb. And the reality is, all the evidence and research shows, regardless of the age, it's much better to be direct, express your concerns, and ask clearly and directly, are you having thoughts of suicide? The reality is, thoughts will not take a person's life. It's the progression from thought to behavior that we want to intervene on. So, I want to say this in addition, I couldn't be prouder of the chief. Chief Summers, Sam Cochran in Memphis, who started CIT, would be so excited to have heard your description, because that's exactly what we're finding throughout the country in the communities that have inserted CIT into their arsenal of resources, is that we're de-escalating, we're lowering the amount of arrests, and we're getting people the help they need. But more importantly, it has a Trojan horse effect. Law enforcement in our country are 5 times more likely to use their weapon on themselves than in the line of duty. So it creates this peer-to-peer resource where law enforcement can reach out to another person in uniform and say, look, I'm having this problem. Where can I go for help? And it becomes an incredible resource within our law enforcement community to deal with a very traumatic, very high-stress job on a day-to-day basis, minute by minute. So Sam Cochran would be very proud of what you said. But with that, I want you to know that postvention is also prevention. Because when someone's touched by suicide, their risk for suicide goes up. Friends, peers, regardless, this is not about a biological factor. This is about the reality that role modeling can increase risk as much as 12 times greater in some studies. What we know is that we can identify those people at risk because we see them at the scene. And we can talk to them about getting the help they're going to need. Because trauma will lay in wait and come upon a person and take them out. Trauma and grief are separate psychological constructs. And part of what we'll do on day one is explain that. Because first you have to build capacity. And at this time of year, I'll say we got to cook the meal and set the table for day two, where we hope people will come and join the banquet. But the day one is going to be about building the capacity, because every community is going to experience both man-made and natural disasters that have trauma attached. And if we help people at that time, we at least reduce one element, and that's the trauma piece, which is the more dangerous psychological impact.
Mary Bowers, we talked about this, I think, in the wake of Mr. Williams' suicide, the last go-around, that this modeling that Dr. Campbell talked about is definitely a point, and you couple that with the natural trauma of life or anything else, and you are setting up a predisposition, it would seem.
Yeah, right. I remember where I was at, actually, at the very moment when we heard about Robin Williams' death. I was at a conference, and I got back to my hotel room, and it was just amazing, too, at all the different emails that were coming out and all the Facebook posts about how traumatic it was for people to hear about this.
And you saw it, I think, Jay, over at Appalachia, where people were going, my God, if this man who had it all, the international acclaim and riches and so many levels, if suicide was to his way of thinking, the only logical conclusion for his life, what hope is there for me or for other people I know?
Well, I think it goes to something that Dr. Campbell just said very well, which had to do with the Trojan horse effect of the CIT training with law enforcement. And it's really larger than law enforcement. I'm thinking about the fact that at Appalachia Center, there are 3,000 people annually who are coming through our doors because they are at immediate risk to self or others. It's about half of the total population that we treat. Those are the folks who are coming through as emergency cases, usually brought by law enforcement. So here are folks who all have families. They may be connected or not, but there's nobody who doesn't somewhere have a family, even if it's sort of in the absence of it. These are folks who are all touched by law enforcement, and these are all folks who are touched by the mental health staff, by the nurses and the doctors and the psych techs who work with them. And I think that one of the dangers of this work is that if there's a stigma about talking about trauma and the impact of trauma, including vicarious trauma, on folks who work with survivors of these kinds of situations and folks who have made attempts themselves, it makes it much harder for people to get up in the morning and face the job every day. And that's true for law enforcement, for medical professionals. And so I think anything that we can do you were talking about Robin Williams' death. I think anything that we can do to get the actual information out about how this works, to take it out of the shadows and put it into a place where it's the same kind of topic of conversation as any other medical issue is, I think that's all to the good.
And Dr. Campbell, I think that was something that you had referenced in describing the curriculum, if you will, for the upcoming conference, the latter part of January at Tallahassee Community College, not just providing the firepower, the resources, the organizational structure for a lost team, but also how do you make this issue more front burner when it comes to the community as a whole? How do you get this information out there beyond the confines of the conference?
Well, absolutely. Early on in the Lost Team development, the Discovery Channel ran three documentaries on my work, and one of those ended up being an international hour-long video that ran. And apparently in a lot of countries, they don't have much to watch on Discovery, so it apparently ran a lot during that period. But what I found was people wanted to have a Lost Team, but they had not built capacity for it. They didn't even have resources for survivors. So it's kind of from their intuition, they knew they needed this, but they didn't even realize that they needed services in addition. So I developed this first a piece called a capacity building workshop on post-venture services. I think we take it for granted that all of the professionals from the chief and all the other first responders are out there doing this for every time there's a death. And that's not part of what most communities provide. So first you have to build capacity. You have to have people say, yeah, I think we need this service. Because after all, if a school bus turns over and the number of children are killed, it will exceed the morgue's ability to handle that death scene. And that in itself develops a trauma scene that will become a crisis and it's a large fatality environment. But every time there's a death, it creates a traumatic scene, regardless of the method or the time of death or the day of death or what are the precipitating events. So as Jay has mentioned...
Doctor, hold that thought just a second. We're rapidly coming up on a break here, and we'll continue that on the other side of it. 414-1234 on Perspectives, the upcoming Suicide Prevention Conference, sponsored by NAMI Tallahassee, January 27th and 28th out of TCC. More to come in just a moment. We are back on Perspectives, and a reminder, you can always find Perspectives online at WFSU.org. Just go to our website, click on Radio, pull down the Programs menu, and then click Perspectives. We archive past shows, trying to have the latest program up within a few hours of when it actually airs. So by close of business today, if you missed the beginning of the program, you're just tuning in now, you can go back to WFSU.org and pull it back up. Dr. Frank Campbell, who is a certified guy in thanatology and forensic suicidology on the other end of the line, talking about the conference coming up January 27th and 28th at TCC here in Tallahassee. And Dr. Campbell, I interrupted you right before the break. Please continue your thoughts, sir.
Well, I was mainly just summarizing that first you have to build capacity about postvention. Postvention just means after a death. So would be prevention that we're all familiar with before there's an attempt or a person that dies. Intervention would be during the time in which a person is thinking about dying or in the act of taking their life. Postvention are the services that occur after there has been an attempt or a death by suicide. So if you think of it as a circle, every prevention effort we have reduces intervention. When intervention occurs and is successful, then we reduce postvention. When postvention is successful, then people get the help they need, and that may remove them from thinking about suicide or acting on those thoughts in the future. So it's more of a circle of services, and I will demonstrate on day one how these kinds of traumatic events can bring anyone to that place where they're having thoughts of suicide, regardless of their background, et cetera. I think we believe that people are protected from thoughts of suicide. Research shows differently. 5% of our population on any given day have thoughts of suicide. And that's an enormous number when you multiply it out.
TCC Police Chief Chris Summers, how often is law enforcement called in to handle this? I know that someone in my family is on the verge. I feel this coming on. I don't know what to do. I call the cops. Mm-hmm. How often do you guys have to go in and do that intervention that Dr. Campbell was just talking about, that you are like the last appeal that a family has in a situation like this?
I'd say periodic. I'd hate to say frequent, but probably more periodic. And it usually kind of almost as you kind of phrase the question becomes a buildup. We'd be remiss if we didn't talk about coping skills and problem solving, because everybody has different levels of it and abilities. And when within, we'll say it's within the capacity of the family to manage through a problem like that, when they reach the point where they're out of tools, that's when they'll call law enforcement or other first responders. Maybe it's a call to EMS. Maybe it's calls to friends. But when we get involved, then it can be during this time of year. And so as we said, we try to come in with some tools in our toolbox to help kind of build a look towards tomorrow perspective, aid the families, aid the individual who's going through the crisis themselves. I don't have the hard numbers, but yes, there is a seasonal aspect to it, it seems like. And as you said earlier, I mean, weather, whatever contributes to the feeling of aloneness or a hopelessness, is when you're going to see calls for service like this increase. I think we spoke about maybe a national tragedy, maybe a local tragedy, all of a sudden can kick into a kind of a network or a thought process of somebody falling into a crisis.
Yeah, essentially, you don't know what the final straw is going to be.
Right. And it varies. It varies by individual.
Mm-hmm. And Mary Bowers, usually, though, as Chris said, it's not law enforcement that's called in. The family has to deal with this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they do. But fortunately, here in Tallahassee, we've got so many officers trained, with CIT. And if we can get the word out, too, now to all these families, you know that mental health really is an issue and that you do have those resources. I know a number of people who've had to call for help, and I've got to tell you, it's getting better and better. A neighbor just a couple doors down who was fostering someone really didn't know. She had never been doing this before, and she had a couple of CIT officers come out, and she told me, oh, my God, they were so wonderful. You know, they stayed for a long time to help de-escalate the situation. So we really are fortunate here in Leon County.
Yeah, but I think more people need to know that, because, Jerry, if I'm thinking of if something goes wrong with my dishwasher, I don't try to fix it myself. I call an expert, someone who is knowledgeable and skilled and has the tools and talent to deal with this. If we have a family crisis, a potential suicide situation, why are we so loath to get involved? We don't want people to know. We feel guilty. What goes on there?
I think one of I think you actually put your finger on it. I think that the stigma and prejudice around suicide and really all kinds of behavioral health issues, it continues to be enormous. As Mary said, it's getting a lot better. And one of the things about the CIT training program that I can't say enough good things about, because I hear this from clients all the time, is that it's a recognition of the fact that law enforcement tends to be our first line of response to any kind of mental health crisis, including an attempted suicide. And so rather than sort of worry about that in terms of the implications for public health response, training officers in CIT and having a cadre of CIT trained officers who can actually be requested if there's a mental health crisis. Folks can call, talk to the dispatcher, and talk to the folks at 911 and said, you know, there's a mental health issue. Can you send a CIT trained officer? And they do a fantastic job. We had, in reference to what the chief was saying a minute ago, I mean, on average, we probably see in this community about three, I'd say that's a minimal number, but about three transported Baker-acted clients who are describing suicidal tendencies on a daily basis. And that's you know, I think that's actually, if anything, it's an underestimation. But of folks who are brought into TMH, CRMC, or Appalachia's emergency services and say, I feel like killing myself, I need some help, I think actually probably it's closer to four a day.
Wow.
Yeah.
That I did not realize that. That is incredible. Well, Dr. Campbell, between the input we're getting here from around the table, it would seem as though you kind of have a good launching structure here for the local lost team organization when you get into town next month, huh?
Absolutely. Between the resources you have there in the studio and the others that Mary's introduced me to and told me about, Tallahassee couldn't be better positioned to provide this service. Having a CIT statewide protocol that the chief talked about earlier just means that once Tallahassee masters this resource, my belief is it will spread through law enforcement as the resource everybody wants to have. That's what we see in Ohio and other states where they have, you know, 20 or more teams, is that the coroners and law enforcement together say, you really ought to look into this. And what they find is their job becomes more compatible with the community. And so they're already making great strides in your community with CIT outcomes. This would just support and enhance that, as opposed to being someone who's going to get in the way. Because law enforcement provide the crime scene etiquette training. So they're trained by local law enforcement. The most important word in the team structure of laws is local. You don't need people coming from outside your community to provide these resources. It would be less than helpful. It makes much more sense for it to be local because you have such great resources already. But going through that doorway, those barriers that Jay talked about, they're not fictitious. They're real. And so we don't want folks to get to the point where they lose hope. We want them to have that hope. If I go and talk to someone, maybe things could change. Just as the weather can change, maybe things could change internally for me, and I wouldn't be so out of congruence with my reality.
Oh, that's a really great point. But, Chief Summers, I'm talking to your colleagues at other law enforcement agencies, whether it's FSU, PD, Tallahassee Police Department, Leon County Sheriff's Office, even FDLE. Are officers receptive to this, or do you get some pushback like, oh, God, just something else we got to deal with now?
No. It actually, it's never been set up as a mandatory. The program sells itself. And when I was involved in the delivery earlier in my career, we kind of gauged the success of the class. And Jay knows because we've talked about it. When you take a break and then you watch the officers or people going through the training go speak to the instructors on the break. So that becomes a very powerful assessment tool on how the class is going. Every class is different because it's based on everybody's unique perspectives, but something that we would look for, too, is buy-in. Do you get buy-in the first day? Do you get buy-in day two? It seems to be that when you have what they call the family part, where you have folks come in to talk to the officers who have been through this, you usually will get your full buy-in, if not 100%, right after that block is delivered. So it's now purposefully delivered as soon towards the first day or two of the class.
I heard one officer I know, and I will not mention his name because he knows where I live, and he has a gun, but had been through this type of situation, and he said it is transformative. Yeah. Very often from a law enforcement perspective, it changes the attitude from when the call comes, the immediate reaction is no longer bad guy.
Yeah.
It really gives officers another level of contemplating their service, their response to the community in a very helpful way. And we've seen what happens sometimes when officers overreact or escalate rather than de-escalate a situation. This training helps to mitigate that kind of thing.
Oh yeah, absolutely. You know, you get the ability to come in and to a, what I would used to say, you're in the lab. We're in the lab, so we have the ability for this week to answer the questions that maybe we couldn't answer out in the field in the middle of a call. We have the experts who come in to take the time to piece that the rest of that information together. They learn more about the pharmacology side, you know, the medications that are involved and what works, what doesn't, what has immediate effects versus, hey, this is the type of medication there has to be a buildup. Or on the same token, you know, that they may be witnessing and seeing symptoms of somebody who's not been taking their medication and it's a week or two or maybe a month beyond, add in maybe some other substances. So it's really becomes that arena for them, A, to ask those questions. We don't like, typically don't like to bring a brand new officer fresh from the academy in there. We prefer to bring in an officer who's got a couple of years in a uniform patrol assignment, because now they actually have some other calls for service, some incidents that they've been involved in. And you couple the new information, maybe the re-emphasized information, depending on what their background education may be, and now some work experience and then some life experience from some other folks. So it's very powerful. And you will see with some classes by lunch on day one, buy-in.
Very different. And Jay Reeve, that means law enforcement as mental health partners.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, the funny thing about it is that law enforcement have always been mental health partners. We just haven't always treated law enforcement as if they're mental health partners. But with CIT and the involvement of, as Chief was saying, the professionals in the community and the volume of folks who've gone through the program now. I was thinking about this at our last CIT training, and we host those at Appalachie Center, and so we'd have a little lunch and graduation ceremony we go through, and I was thinking about the number of those that I've been through in the last 11 years that I've been here and how many officers are now on the street, sheriff's deputies are on the street who've been trained in this, and it gives you a great feeling of confidence about your community to have that sense that you have first responders who have this level of training and this level of engagement. It's a terrific thing.
And Dr. Frank Campbell, maybe hard to quantify here this far out since all of this, we're looking forward, we're anticipating all this working hand in glove with the existing CIT. You come in, help put together with Mary's help and all the other partners, a loss team, an effective loss team for Tallahassee. What does that do as far as reducing the incidence of suicide? Is there any way to quantify that in advance and say, hey, we're looking for a 30% reduction, a 50%, what?
Well, I wouldn't be able to promise that. I wish I could. What I can say is that survivors who get help don't tend to take their lives. I don't know of any who have gotten help that have taken their lives. And most of our research that says they're 12 times more at risk is based on people who did not get help. So we do know it's a high-risk factor. But one of the things that you hit on with CIT is exactly what we're going to do on day one. We're going to talk a common language. And as Jay and Chief Summers were saying, just taking the mystery out of medication responses, finding words that we can share, quickens our ability to help people by having a common language around mental health and suicide. We can shorten that gap between a person experiencing a death or discovering a loved one dead and getting the help they need. Because law enforcement will be able to be part of that loss team learning these words that shorten and avoid pain. Let me just give you a common one. All too often, we still in our vernacular today use the word committed suicide. And if we can just remove committed from that sentence, we avoid punishing families. Mm-hmm. Because the truth is, it's not a crime. And we still had that word holding over from days when it was determined by the crowner to be a suicide and therefore a punishable act. Of the family were punished, not just the deceased and their body discarded, but the family was literally carrying the brunt and the stigma comes out of that. So just by saying someone suicided, we change that whole vernacular. And if someone is having thoughts of suicide, that's different than suiciding, where they're actually on a bridge or have a weapon to their head. So we can change these words and stop modifying, because we don't do that with murder.
That is true. And, Doctor, I think words have power, and your words have had incredible power today. We're running out of time. Mary Bowers, how do you find out more about the conference in advance?
You go to NAMI-Tallahassee.org/loss registration.
Mary Bowers from NAMI, thank you so much. Jay Reeves from the Appalachian Center, and Tallahassee Community College Police Chief Chris Summers, along with Dr. Frank Campbell. Thank you all for being on Perspectives, and happy holidays to all. Perspectives produced by WFSU-FM in Tallahassee. Lydell Rawls and Taylor Cox on the board today, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Next week, Tallahassee Symphony music director and conductor Darko Butorac, he and I spinning some unique holiday songs for you. Hope you can tune in and sing along next week on Perspectives.
Audio copies of Perspectives are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. Log on to WFSU.org for online archives and podcast. Perspectives is a production of 88.9 WFSU-FM, Tallahassee.